Basically, my research was about the transition of nativist parties into something that was palatable and acceptable to, like, very large percentages of the population in contemporary Western Europe. With a lot of that was that aspects of nationalism had become taboo after World War II, obviously enough for the horrors of the Nazi regime, the Holocaust, the murder of Jews, homosexuals, the imperialism of the Third Reich and the Axis in general. So in this sense, nationalism, many aspects of it were rather taboo. Of course, those principal aspects would be things like biological race, racism, pronounced anti-Semitism, militarism, you know, the sort of totalitarianism that was so apparent in Nazism, and of course its ideological opponent, certainly totalitarianism, was apparent in Soviet communism as well. And I became interested, I had a long enduring interest in World War II and I guess what you'd call radical politics, both nationalist and socialist politics. And I was curious to see how these parties in Europe were really advancing at a great rate of knots, going from relative political outsiders often in the 90s into, you know, being parties that assist forming government, like the Danish People Parties had, which was one of my case study subjects. And particularly interested in the French National Front, with the transition from Jean-Marie Le Pen to Marine Le Pen, who is probably the most symbolic evidence of this transition from this sort of old nationalist style of politics with, you know, fairly nuanced Jew baiting on his part often enough. And the early Front National had some people that were basically neo-fascists involved in it early on in the piece, one being François Duprat, who was supposedly murdered by Mossad because he was a Holocaust revisionist and had close relationships with Palestinians and Baathists. And, of course, you have the younger daughter now that is doing extremely well in the polls. The French National Front won the European elections last year. The Danish People Party is polling really well. The Sweden Democrats are polling extremely well. Vlaams Belang, which is one of the other case study subjects I did, is trailing behind a little bit because a liberal sort of nationalist party has moved into that political space. And the other case study subject I did was a radical ethno-regionalist group called Bloc Identitaire, who are most famous possibly for doing a mosque occupation. There's a mosque site in Poitiers in France. Poitiers was the place where there was a battle between Charles Martel, a Frankish king at the time, against Moors coming further north from Spain, and this was kind of like, in symbolically at least anyway, often considered to be one of the earliest victories of the repulsed Islam from Europe, and that occurred in 732. Mm-hmm. So I used these case subjects and just became interested in how these parties and party families were kind of evolving at such a great knots, where previously there'd been such a taboo around you know, radical nationalism or even strong nationalism due to those horrific events that occurred in World War II, and the fact that they were like a really seriously growing party family. There's a few places where they haven't been so successful. Probably most notably would be England and Germany. Of course, Germany has a huge problem with any public associations with Nazism, except for a few extremely radical, I guess, people that are probably crypto-fascists or crypto-Nazis, like the NPD in Germany. I think they've just won a seat for the first time last year, possibly, and Britain also too. The British National Party got one or two seats in the European Parliament the election before last, and they are basically, again, they have a foundation in kind of these post-Nazi white supremacist politics, but we're moving into this sort of more populist or nativist, I guess, authoritarian position where they claim to be the authentic Democrats acting for the people against the globalizing elites. So that was kind of the thrust of my research.
And one of the questions you pose is, Are these parties and social movements fascist? So maybe we can examine that a bit, because, you know, coming from different perspectives and the media has their agenda and a lot of people have their agendas, how would we deconstruct that? You know, who's fascist, or there's fascist elements, and maybe we can take a look at that question.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I suppose, again, fascism and Nazism are generally taboo in Western Europe. There's a few exceptions to that, like the National Democratic Party in Germany, and there's another movement in Italy called Casa Pound, named after the poet Ezra Pound, and they are kind of like 21st century fascists. They're quite, they're kind of like radical nationalists, and they've got very left approaches as well. But electorally, they're not really significant. In Italy, the significant electorally significant movement is the Lega Nord, which are, again, I put them in this party family of authoritarian nativist populists. They're very critical of Islam. And they're kind of, well, I suppose one of the principal differences I see, there's a number of them between the, you know, radical nationalism of World War II and the precursors to those movements like Action Française, is that these parties make a real effort at being democratic, but a democracy that kind of supports the popular will. So in this sense, you know, fascists are totalitarian, as are Nazis. Electoral politics are not big for them. But if we look at where parties of this type have done most successfully, they tend to be in, not where they've polled most successfully, but where they've done electorally most successfully, they tend to be in places like Switzerland, which has like a lot of direct democracy involved in their political organization. Of course, famously the Swiss People's Party, which is another party that I classify as authoritarian nativist populist party, is, you know, has successfully banned the construction of minarets. They've restricted immigration, and there seems to be like a real groundswell. Polls suggest that a lot of people in Europe are deeply concerned about the place that Islam plays, and of course you've got other factors that deflect. Globalization is occurring simultaneously as there's very large demographic shifts, particularly regarding Muslim immigrants. And of course you've got these manufacturing jobs disappearing to China, India, Cambodia, Laos, places like that. So there's a lot of insecurity in a economic sense in Europe at the time, and there's a lot of insecurity in a cultural sense as well. So there's actually like a, to do so well electorally, there has to be some democratic impetus for the policies these parties are offering. That's one of the thing that distinguishes them from fascists and Nazis. They are actually, they're democratic parties. Most of the parties that I've discussed have been engaged in electoral politics for decades. The Front National has been around since 1972, and, you know, went through a lot of fairly average years of not much electoral success till the current day, where they're, you know, some 40, 50 years later, they're doing quite well. There's been no indication that any of these parties would try and seize power once they were elected. They have sort of deeply engaged in the democratic process. And if anything, their complaints that what they're experiencing these days from both the EU and the political electoral systems within their host countries is, you know, deeply undemocratic. I think the Front National got about 12-15% of the vote, something like that, at last election, and they got two seats, one being Jean-Marie Le Pen's granddaughter. And the same thing goes for UKIP, which I don't consider, I consider that a libertarian populist party. I don't really consider that a nativist populist party. I think got, again, like 12-15% of the vote and got one or two seats, if that. So they're kind of claiming that actually electoral systems are deeply undemocratic. A lot of people vote for them and they're not getting enough representation in the parliament. Were you going to say something?
Let's take a look at the National Front. Some interesting things are going on there. And actually, a funny story, back when I was a graduate student in Geneva, I actually had a coffee with Aymeric Chauprade. Are you familiar with him?
I am familiar with him, yes.
Yeah,
and very interesting character.
Yeah, and you know, I totally respect him from the geopolitical perspective. I thought he had great work. And this was back, 7 years ago, before he had anything to do with the National Front. And Well, now he's the what? The European MEP and
I think he's the MEP for Île-de-France, which is kind of like the Paris region, and he's the foreign affairs spokesman of something like that, or he's like their advisor on international relations.
Yeah, he's the foreign policy advisor, and so we see now, you know, with the National Front accusations of, with a lot of these right parties, they throw accusations of racism, and obviously there have been people in some of these parties who have made statements. I think you just mentioned Marine Le Pen's father going back, and now they're trying to, I guess they purged him, no, from his own party. And what are your thoughts of the politics right now of the National Front and the outlook for them?
Well, the thing I distinguish in is it's kind of, I define a movement from a position I guess I'd call racism, which is like very overt biological racism, evidenced in you know, the Nazis and associated groups like the Iron Guard, what have you, very profound anti-Semitism as well, to a horrifically murderous extent in those cases. But then you get what I suggest these parties use now is something called culturalism, whereby they define themselves not by racial or biological markers generally, they define themselves by a culture. So this being the case, an Arab can join the Front National without any problem, or an Arab French person, or a black French person, or a Vietnamese French person, as long as they're willing to fully, I guess, assimilate into what is perceived the norm of French culture, which is, you know, Enlightenment values on top of Christianity, and on top of like how the French people engage with the world. So in this sense, they believe they can only so many people can adopt, you know, assimilate at a time, because, you know, demographically a lot of Western Europe's challenged at this point in history because people aren't having enough children. Maybe that's because they feel insecure with the economic scenario. I don't think they're racist at all. I think there's been a real transition, particularly Marine Le Pen has probably been a really key in that, because, as you know, the original Front National was made up of a diverse array of various nationalist and native groups, from people that wanted Algeria to remain part of the empire through to revolutionary nationalists, neo-fascists, you know, really rigorous traditionalist Catholics. That was quite a conglomerate through to, like, you know, populists. And another group that's crucially important, in my opinion, anyway, is a group called the Nouvelle Droite, which is the French New Right. And unlike the New Right in the Anglosphere, their New Right was principally concerned about culture as opposed to, like, neoliberal economics. So this is why I don't call these parties right parties. I call them nationalist parties, because to most English-speaking people, right means neoliberalism. The New Right developed the idea called ethno-pluralism, which is where distinct cultures and groups that have the right to be left in relative autonomy in a geographical space. So that's the way they kind of moved away from the racist imperialism of Nazism and moved towards sort of a more defensive sort of, you know, I guess, regionalist position. There was even involvement of like sort of organic farming and sort of like a pastoral rural ideal to a certain extent in some of that. And that still exists in Bloc Identitaire. Even they were the ones that developed a concern about, you know, people about the halal food in France. So they would do things like support traditional French cuisine, have sausage and plonk parties, and that caused like strategic provocations like that, which got them a lot of media attention for a very small, relatively small group. Hey? And so I think there's been a real transition, and a lot of people, I have arguments with other academics that research the issue. Because there is a tendency for them to still be considered fascists or extreme right or Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually see that they're a new and distinct party family has emerged in a relatively recent time. So what were you going to say?
So then you differentiate some of these groups. You call them the national populists, and then others you call the far right. Yeah.
I don't even call fascists far right. I think that's a misnomer. I call them like extreme nationalists or nativists. There are parties like that do exist in Europe. Recently in France, there was one called the what was it, young nationalist revolutionaries, which, you know, basically were a bunch of 45-year-old skinheads that had kind of not grown up over their sort of fascist fetishism and would parade up and down the street in sort of like skinhead outfits. That they are, you know, distinctly fascist groups. Of course, in Eastern Europe, you know, Golden Dawn, Jobbik, you know, these people really consciously draw on that history, both aesthetically and in their program. And I don't think that can be reasonably said of parties like the Dutch People's Party, Front National, or Vlaams Belang these days, even though there may be a few old people in those groups that still have those ideas. They've really, particularly the Front National, as a party in transition, and I don't think that would you could ever say that about the Danish People's Party, which have been, you know, a very strong supporters of Israel historically. They support the welfare state. So my position is essentially the most successful of these populist parties have a roughly left economics and you know, concerned about Islamism and a culturally centered center right. That's kind of my position, because that's what their constituency wants.
Well, and so we see a general trend in the rise of the right, or let's say national populism, and it seems a lot of people are fed up with the status quo. You know, the economy is doing really bad in Europe, and so people then want to turn to anything else than the status quo, the left or the center. And how would you look at that? You know, why are people turning the other direction, and why are some of these parties becoming so popular?
Well, my sort of thinking is, in Europe, when I haven't been there. I went there when I was in my early 20s. I'm now sort of 45-ish, and I went there a year ago. And there is a real sense of decay when you walk through certain parts of particularly France, Belgium. Denmark was in pretty good shape, but a lot of it looks like it's really starting to age. And coming from Australia too, there's like Australia, Canada, America, I guess, are probably the most multicultural countries in the world. Maybe, I don't know what Mexico is like, but there's a lot of people from a lot of different places here, and there usually tends to be a kind of, there's a graduation or an incrementalism. When you walk through a major city in Melbourne, you might walk through a Turkish area or a Greek area or an Italian or whatever it may be, and there's kind of, but when I went into parts of France, I guess a lot of this would be economically based too, there's almost very distinct demarcations between places where, I guess you'd call them native French would be, and places where immigrants are. And there seemed to be a lot of hostility and tension there. This is, of course, not empirical data. It's just my own perception. I'm sure that's not universally the case. So there's kind of like I guess some people feel culturally threatened by very large numbers of immigration. I imagine this is getting more and more pronounced with the refugee crisis on at the moment. The other interesting thing is, which you don't get in England so much or Germany so much, France has a really strong intellectual transition of this kind of nativist right, which is, most people think of these people as being cretins or thugs or skinheads and stuff like that. And you talk to them and they're very, very intelligent people that argue from a certain position, which may not be so popular in Anglophone countries, but they're very articulate presenting that opinion. Marine Le Pen in particular is a very capable debater and public speaker. In Australia, we had one of the earliest of these parties, and that was what called One Nation. There was a lady called Pauline Hanson who was anything but an elite. It was quite inarticulate, which I guess was part of her attraction for some people. But in Europe, these people are like, you know, very capable, very intelligent, quite well-reasoned generally. And also, of course, you've got this, you know, in America, they call it the 1%. You just have globalization seems to have really done wonderful things for a lot of the elites and a lot of people at the top, but a lot of people feel themselves languishing. Middle class and working class folks feel themselves falling by the wayside, job casualization, outsourcing to lower wage countries. So in this sense, there's like a kind of a small percentage of people are being drawn up, which are, you know, those people that have done well in the corporate world, whereas, you know, middle-class people, I guess, feel a lot more fragile in the circumstance. So it's this combination. And, of course, you know, you get parties like Syriza, you get Jeremy Corbyn in England, you get, you know, parties of seriously left parties that are looking at things like renationalization, which is, there's just like an aversion to neoliberalism, because I believe a lot of people, particularly working and middle class people, are really struggling in that scenario. And then you add that to cultural concerns about mass immigration and the your cultural environment shifting radically quickly for a lot of that people, that's a deep worry. And they vote accordingly, you know. So it's kind of like almost the peripheral against the centre, and the centre is crumbling rather quickly in a lot of places. For that reason, it seems to be a very unequal redistribution of the new wealth that globalism has brought to some people and taken away from others.
And let's take a look at immigration briefly. You know, I have a neighbor here from Britain, and he has a wife. I have a neighbor here from Britain, and he has a wife from South America. And a few years ago, they were trying to go back to Britain, and he tells me it's overpopulated Britain, and that they won't give his wife a visa, so he can't go back to his own country, and he's stuck here in Mexico. So, you know, does the right have a point with immigration, or have they gone a little step too far? You know, the criticism they have for the left is that, you know, the welfare state, the state can't absorb all these people. And, you know, what are your thoughts on immigration?
Well, immigration is the core issue of the these nationalist populist parties. And of course, when I was interviewing a guy called Søren Espersen, who was an ex-journalist, and he was deputy leader of the Danish People's Parties, and he was essentially, we're a social democratic party in the tradition of Scandinavia, but we realise that Denmark and other countries, the welfare state can only support so many people. And when I went to their party conference to do some interviews and to observe, and the apparent thing is with most of these parties, you look at who their supporters are, and they're certainly not people that will be going to Davos anytime soon. They tend to be, middle and working class people, small business people. They're the ones that really haven't done brilliantly out of globalization as a general rule. That's not always the case, but that tends to be the case. So they're voting. The voters are traditionally voters who would normally vote for parties like Labour or Social Democratic parties. If you look at like the number of votes UKIP took, which I think is probably a lot worse for working class and middle class voters, because it's essentially a libertarian party, that they took a lot of votes from Labour as well. So there's a real disenchantment with a lot of these, with these sort of Blairite Labour parties, because they are basically neoliberal parties and they're marginally nicer than the centre-right parties to those that don't do so well economically for whatever reasons. So immigration is a real issue, and there is a sense, particularly for a lot of them older people as well, not all of them, but there's a sense that those are less that those less well off and those less, you know, those struggling and doing casual work, their immediate competition is of course going to be unskilled immigrants that come over in very large numbers. So I guess even the BNP and parties like that, you look at where they do well, and they generally do well in working class communities or those that are in some degree of decline. So immigration is probably good for some people, but for a lot of people, they see it as, I guess, a realistic conflict theory. And in Australia, we have a huge amount of immigrants here too, but they tend to be selected on the grounds of how appropriate they are for the economy at the time. It's quite targeted in that sense. And of course, even people over here complain there's too many immigrants and there's a lot of unemployment here. So why would we need relatively unskilled immigrants when we could train up our own citizens, regardless of their ethnic background? So immigration is a huge issue over there. And of course, the thing is, it's not just immigration as such, because you look at Britain and there's not a huge amount of concern about Hindu immigration or immigration from Vietnam, for example. In France, as you know, France once had a very large Indo-Chinese colony or empire. So there's not, the FN doesn't make issue with Vietnamese French or, so much French from the Congo or other parts of, I guess, Christian Africa or animist Africa. But Islam is kind of like the real issue that does that does concern all the parties I studied, because they see this as a religio-political system more than they see it as a cultural thing. They're very concerned about the social norms and the legal norms in Islamism, which is the political Islam. And, of course, they're concerned about potential violence as well, because there have been some acts of terrorism.
I mean, and
so you get kind of – sorry, please, keep going.
There is some cause for concern regarding, let's say, radical Islamism, because, for example, I remember reading in Germany – a few years ago, they had some of the radicals walking the streets of Germany and attempting to impose Sharia law. I don't know if you saw that story.
I do. Yeah, they're usually called Salafists.
Right.
Salafi Muslims usually follow the earliest Muslims, so Muhammad and those people directly around him. So they kind of hope to return to a golden age of Islam or Islamism, as the case may be. They're not necessarily violent or aggressive. They're not necessarily jihadists even. A lot of them are kind of quietist, but they do tend to segregate, because their approach to Islam is very, very distinct from Western European norms. They tend to, dress more conservatively. I mean, I suppose there's a huge kind of shades of grey. At one extreme, you'd have those sort of nominal Muslims that are just there because their parents were, and at the other end of that, you have these incredibly rigorous expressions of Islam that are sort of like you'd find more often in Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, where the women won't even show their hands because that's considered immodest. It can be like quite extreme, particularly for Western Europe, which is, women wander around on beaches in the nude quite frequently. They dress in a very liberal and relaxed sense. But when you get these sort of two cultures clashing, it can be deeply problematic. Some Muslims, fit into the program extraordinarily well in Europe, whereas others that – I guess what I'm trying to say is the more radically conservative almost Muslims take their religion, the more mutual exclusivity there is going to between how they approach existence and sort of Western European norms. And they're very visible differences too. To cover yourself fully, to cover your face is considered antisocial and deeply illiberal by the French, and the Belgians have banned it. And a lot of people have issues with it elsewhere too. And of course, some of these, there's almost like a mutual segregation where some Muslim communities in certain places, you go there and it's actually like people live a very, very different life than they would just on the other side of a different street or a river or whatever. Sorry, please go ahead.
Just to touch on that, I had a French student last semester. I have internet exchange students from abroad usually, and we were talking about this, and he mentioned that, it was on the news some months back that, like you said, there's kind of segregated. They have their own communities in France. And the story said in the news that it was dangerous to go into some of these communities. And so I asked him personally, being from France, and he said yes. He said that in some of these communities, perhaps, at the nighttime, I don't know, that he would be afraid to visit. So
yeah, it's I'm, Melbourne, where I spent most of my life, has got all sorts of people from all sorts of places, and like my best friends have a Greek background, and I've had friends of Asian backgrounds, and got along with everyone pretty well. But I did notice in Europe there is a real kind of segregation, and the term it's most often used is parallel societies. And I guess, you don't find these so much with French Vietnamese or, probably French guys with a Congolese background or whatever. But because the thing is, you've got to understand, Islamism has its political expression has become much stronger as well. There's a lot of money coming from Gulf states to start new mosques in Europe and all over the world, really. And a lot of that, their expression of Islam is quite strict compared to what you might find in parts of Indonesia or Turkey or Kurdistan or places like that. It's you know, it's quite austere. Wahhabism is the official form of Islam in Saudi Arabia. It's quite austere. They do have corporal punishments. There is quite strict gender segregation. It's a relatively literal reading, whereas you go to places like Turkey and it's quite relaxed. But the fact is, this a lot of money coming from Gulf states, essentially petrodollars, and I guess this expresses or expands this particular style of Islam into Europe. And of course, it's a for a lot of Europeans that are not used to this sort of thing, it's quite confronting to them. Whereas they're probably pretty cool, like, you know, they might have had some Algerian friends or people from that background. But I guess the real difference is, and a real concern a lot of people of that, I guess, populist or nationalist orientation express, is that these children of these guys are so much more radical than their grandparents. You know, it's gone from this kind of traditional folky Islam to a much more austere, political, rigorous expression of it, where they're concerned about issues like Palestine, they're concerned about, and like Sharia, they want the introduction of Sharia law for their own communities. And yeah, I was speaking to a few Belgian people in Brussels, and they all referred to the areas where the Muslim communities lives as the Bronx or the ghetto, or don't go there, or they were all terrified of them. Of course, I went there and had a look in the daytime. It wasn't so bad. But, you know, they have there's a real demarcation between some of the Islamic communities and, I guess, the native European communities there.
And I had a funny anecdote last time. I guess I was in Switzerland because that's where I studied. And I remember last time I went to defend my thesis. Well, this was, 7 years ago in Geneva. And I had to pass through immigration, and they asked me where my permanent address was, which was not in Switzerland. And I remember the officer responding, you know, with a very forceful, good, you know, because I had a I have a Croatian-American background. And the other funny thing, I remember in Switzerland that they can, you know, Mexicans are considered in the U.S. those that do the work that Americans don't want to do, the dirty jobs. I just thought it amusing in Switzerland, the people from the Balkans, like myself, were considered the Mexicans of Switzerland, is what they actually told me.
Same deal, right? Yeah.
It was pretty funny.
That's sort of like, you know, I guess Switzerland, again, has got one of the strongest of these parties with the Swiss People's Party. Did you have experience of them while you were over there or not?
No, I had no experience with them.
Yeah, because they seem to be like, you know, banning minarets and leading a lot of these kind of efforts to keep Switzerland Swiss in their perception of it anyway, so keep it kind of as it stood. And I guess that's kind of the big trajectory for most of these parties to a greater or lesser degree.
And so you also mentioned the momentum towards renationalization in the global age. So what can you say regarding that?
Okay, well, one of the things I'm kind of discovered was that I guess the two principal political expressions, and certainly economic ones, have been capitalism and communism prior to the end of the Cold War. And it seems that there was a feeling of neoliberal capitalism, you know, these sort of radical free markets with them. There was a feeling that this created an atomized consumer unit that was sort of ungrounded in the world or community or culture or even the ecology for that matter. It was a superficial and I suppose meaningless life that was just making, purchasing, buying, consuming. And particularly the new right, French writers, they talk about really being grounded in culture and environment. It's almost like a resacralization of the earth that you're in, I guess. So I guess equivalents would be, indigenous peoples that have a really strong relationship with their actual, you know, living environment. And the other side of that, the other one was communism, which again is this kind of like they perceive it as being participating in this sort of hive mind, which is barely human. So the nationalization thing again is people wanting to return to some sort of roots and have some sense of identity, which is, I guess, one or two steps below being a human, which just seemed to be what the only identities offered by communism and neoliberal capitalism are. So they kind of humans have a real need. The idea was that humans have a real need to feel that they belong. They have a real need for community. They have a real need for identity, and they have a real need for a sense of autonomy as well within that community. And of course, there's the actual economic reality for a lot of people, particularly those in the West, and I imagine places like Japan is much the same. I consider Japan part of the West. With a lot of offshoring, with the rise of China, their life quality is probably a lot less secure than it was for the baby boomer generation. So people are, you know, people are looking at turning back to their own communities for being a bit more self-supportive, for being sustaining. Particularly in France, there was a lot of concern about, Americanization as much as there was about Islamization, which is not something you'd normally consider a right party to be worried about. And that was from a cultural as well as like an economic perspective. They wanted to keep their traditional life, but also, you know, sort of navigate forward because the Front National spokesman understood that globalization was an inevitable process, but there were ways of doing that were so much better for France. They want to maintain their own way of doing and being. They want to retain their own identity, their own nation, their own relative autonomy. And they understand that to do that, they need a degree of, you know, electoral success. And the other thing you notice about France too, which Anglophile countries don't do so much, they really talk about issues that over here that would be considered taboo. They talk about immigration, they talk about racism, they talk about cultural differences, they talk about identity, all in very open ways, which in Europe, in the Anglosphere countries, they're usually avoided because they are, you know, they're confrontational for a lot of people, they're very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there's also this big swing back towards this kind of national identity in France too. There's like a Jewish Algerian background. He's a journalist called Eric Zemmour. He's wrote a book called The Suicide of France, which basically details the deconstruction of the French nation, since the left culture took over in the 60s, and that's an incredibly big bestseller. Their most sort of famous novelist has written an article about an Islamist party taking over parliament because the kind of centrist parties ally with that because they prefer that to Marine Le Pen. So it's actually in France, it's actually really in the high culture. People consider these issues, where in the Anglosphere they're barely apparent. So I just, continental Europeans have a very different way of operating than people from English-speaking countries do, right?
And I think maybe perhaps because in Europe, they're closer, you know, they're at the front of the battle, I guess, with globalization and globalism. I read and research and look a lot at the issue of global governance. And, you know, the EU is the first, the most advanced regional integration, right? Like a super state, supranational, super state. And so a lot of these countries are being, say, swallow it up in some senses by this super state and losing some of their sovereignty. And so I guess they're having to look at some of these issues more than, say, you know, North America, where folks like the late Robert Pastor, who promoted the same movement, you know, European Union style movement in North America, but, you know, it's not advancing at all. And I guess in Australia, the same. I mean, wouldn't you say maybe that's part of the case because they don't have to confront the dynamics in Australia or the US as much as they do in the EU?
Absolutely. So the other thing we've got to consider here is, you know, some European ethno-nations have been around for thousands of years. Like the Basque people have had their own little thing going on that's been around for thousands of years. They're actually like a, you know, an ethnic community. Whereas I suppose it's the same with the Chinese, Tibetans. There's many other nations that have had like an extremely long history. But when you talk about North America, aside from the indigenous people that live there, and Australia, aside from our indigenous people, they're actually very new countries. And I guess we don't have much history. Like Australia's never been to war with New Zealand. Canada and the States have never really gone at it in seriously. There have been wars with Mexico, but it seems like there's a degree of detente or friendliness between the two countries there. Maybe Donald Trump would like to have things otherwise, I'm not sure. But European countries have got tremendous amounts of history where they've been fighting each other. They have very different ways of doing things. They've got long histories of animosity. And, of course, a lot of that erupted into a really two disastrous wars in World War One and World War Two, where millions and millions of people were killed needlessly. But it's just, yeah, I guess they're radically different from each other in some ways. Like the difference between, I don't know, Norway and Greece is huge, you know, or the difference between Croatia and Ireland is huge. Actually, Croatia and Ireland probably have a degree of similarity, but Croatia and, I don't know, Germany or England or Wales is quite significant. So I guess they've got these nations that have, like, often fought really hard to maintain their autonomy, and there is a perception there's a big democratic deficit, that they're being, you know, forced to do various things that are not in their national interest. And a lot of people like the idea of Europe being united, but not in quite the way it is. A lot of people want to go back to their own currencies, like the British have maintained the pound. I think quite a few Greeks wouldn't even mind getting the drachma back. Marine Le Pen wants to get the franc back. But it's sort of more like a confederal organisation or acting as a trading bloc, as opposed to a political organisation that has, like, legal primacy over the national government. So I suppose that's kind of the expression. And another thing is, too, it's when you consider, like, I guess the idea in Mexico is there's all these, you know, probably Mexican people, and I'm sure it's the same in Central America, have been, particularly peasants and rural people, have had their farms taken away from them. There's been a big move from the cities to the countries, and of course then these people next move into the states. So there's this sense of dispossession from a lot of these people. They're, like, really desperate for work and money. The neoliberalism has taken away their farm or their family farm. They're left in a parlous economic circumstance, so they try to get to America. And the thing is, the people in America they compete against are the poorest Americans, who are probably in a similar scenario. And I think that's the same thing in Europe to a certain extent. The people that are coming from Africa or the people that are coming from the Middle East, they're either coming from wars or they're coming to better their economic circumstances, because the neoliberalism has made so many radical changes to, you know, money has shifted, security has shifted, old businesses can't defend themselves against places like Walmart. I'm not sure if that's how things go in Mexico, but I know there's lots of Central Americans and Mexicans that seem to like to move into America, and I guess these guys are just desperate for a better life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And regarding Croatia, you know, the sentiment that I get from a lot of people I know, because we were the last country to join the EU, is they call it Yugoslavia. You know, so we left. we left Yugoslavia. We became an independent republic, and then we joined this again, original blocking, and a lot of people view it as Yugoslavia, and you know, so that's the sentiment there. And what other points that perhaps we didn't mention or didn't really get into? Do you think are important? Any other?
Well, the other point I'd just like to talk about, the possible sort of geopolitical realities that these guys may kind of develop in term. I know that that's kind of one of your main interests. And I can see that for a number of reasons, particularly the Front National and I guess other affiliated parties, possibly to a lesser extent, these are really useful developments for Putin in a geostrategic sense, because you've got a group of very successful parties. I mean, the FN1 is talking about leaving NATO. You've got a group of very successful parties that are in some ways socially conservative. I mean, France is the second biggest economy in the EU, wanting to leave. So in a sense, this is a real challenge for, I guess, American primacy and American influence in Europe, and it's a real challenge for the EU itself. And on Putin, because the FN is still such a marginal party in some ways in Europe, the story goes they couldn't get any money from French banks for campaigning and organisational matters, so they got some money from a Russian bank. And I can see in the long term, this, particularly if they keep going as well as they do, there'll be some real challenges for America and for those sort of Atlanticists, because for a lot of folks, the EU is really on the nose, and that's starting to express itself politically at the polls in a very sort of pronounced fashion. How that will pan out in the distant future, I'm not 100% sure, but I can be certain that Russian geostrategists are very, very happy that these sort of nationalist and populist parties are rising up and sort of wanting to leave the EU, and in some cases have a anti-American, anti-neoliberal, because they believe that neoliberalism is an American invention, and corporations tend to be based in America, Google and these sort of things. So yeah, so I think that's kind of been going to be another development. There could be a reorientation towards Russia, and I've even heard Greeks saying that if Greece eventually does leave the EU, that the Russians will be quite happy to help them, because Greece has traditionally been in the Russian sphere of influence, because they're both Orthodox countries traditionally.
Yeah, and we saw Tsipras visiting with Putin, and he seemed to be flirting, with the East. And I think Varoufakis, who resigned not long ago, basically came out and said that, the idea was to go against the EU with Syriza. They were going to go pedal to the metal, but it seems that Tsipras, there was a compromise in Syriza, and in the end, I guess at least this is what Varoufakis claims, that he resigned because of integrity, because they weren't going to go as far as they originally had set out, and so it seems like Tsipras caved to the EU instead of going more towards the East, towards Russia, as you say.
Sorry, no, please keep going.
No, if you can comment on that.
I was just going to say, in your sort of own ancestral part of the world, what's going on in Serbia and Montenegro regarding sort of potential conflict between EU and Russia as regarding their spheres of influence?
Some podcasts ago, we did a geopolitics of the Balkans, and I spoke with Filip Kovacevic, who's a Montenegrin. And what did he say? Well, I mean, I know in Serbia has also been flirting closely. Like you said, traditionally Serbia is Orthodox, and we view them as brothers with Russia in a sense, but Serbia as well, it seems like a lot of them are, counting the costs, and it's very unclear. They're trying to look out for number one themselves, and there's a lot of carrots dangling, from Russia and from the EU. Mm. And recently Croatia just got basically taken over by the West, by the US NATO establishment, because our first female president elected in December, she was a former high-level NATO assistant secretary, and she was a member of the Western Elite Trilateral Commission. So, pretty much, Croatia has been taken over.
So Croatia's like the Poland of the Southeast or something like that. Is it a bit hectic?
Yeah, I guess I've never heard it said that way, but yeah, that makes sense.
Because that would be one of the sort of bulwarks against, Russian expansion.
Exactly.
Croatia's traditionally a conservative country, or it's traditionally a fairly sort of liberal country?
I'd say, we were part of the communist Yugoslavia, but generally, fair to say, we're pretty conservative, but, a lot of things are changing now. And the other point I was going to make was when you were mentioning France and the move away, I guess, with Russia, mm-hmm. and the move away from Washington. I spoke with Daniele Ganser, who's a Swiss academic that's on the podcast, and his specialty is false flag or state terrorism. And he examined how during the Cold War, a lot of the European states committed state terrorism and blamed it on the left, the communists. And we speculated, because, we can't come to a conclusion with these kinds of events because the evidence is lacking. But we had the Charlie Hebdo, the Paris attacks, right? Mm-hmm. And some people have speculated that France was seeming to turn a bit away from Washington. And some people say that could have been Washington committing that state terrorism in a way to rein France back into their sphere of influence. So we can't come to any conclusions on that, but that was based on his previous historical fact. You know, I think it's a valid speculation.
I'm very reticent to like suggest any terrorist actions have been committed by states. I mean, they certainly, false flags do occur occasionally and at times. That one would seem a very extreme example to me, and I find it extremely unlikely. However, the thing is, if that was the case, you think the Americans would have realized that that sort of act, that sort of disgraceful terrorist act by those, would have most benefited Marine Le Pen, and to have Le Pen in power is not in Washington's interest. Mm-hmm. So even in kind of like a real politics sense, that's kind of the reason I'd suggest it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. But, you know, like I mean, what famous is the Gulf of Tonkin incident? There's quite a few others that have been through history where I think all major empires have used false flags pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other questions or things you'd like to discuss?
Well, the last point was the EU and Russia, and I thought I'd quote Chauprat. I had his quote here. It's what I found. He said that Putin's Russia has become the hope of the world against new totalitarianism. In a sense, I would, you know, Putin's not a great guy and he's authoritarian. But perhaps, I guess he's keeping it, I would agree in that sense, he's keeping at bay a greater totalitarianism, which I would consider, at least the military arm, you know, the US-EU military complex, NATO, which seems to be aggressing on Russia's doorstep. I mean, if you have a comment on that or any other final thoughts or comments.
Well, I suppose Chauprat's the, Marine Le Pen wants to set herself up as the next de Gaulle. She wants that autonomous French approach to foreign affairs, which de Gaulle had. He never joined NATO. She certainly doesn't want to be seen as being like Sarkozy, who was known to be very close to the Americans. So I think probably like the Serbs, as you're saying, if, you know, either of these great empires are willing to drop carrots in front of them, that's to their benefit. Chauprat, I can also see possibly Russia, Iran. The interesting thing I've noticed here is if you look at the incidents of terrorism occurring in Western countries themselves, not occurring against Westerners in other countries, like, you know, the Hezbollah doing a suicide bomb and killing 200 Marines, it's almost as if exclusively all terrorist acts are committed by Sunnis within Europe, by Sunni radicals and Sunni extremists, even though, of course, most Sunnis just are pretty happy to go about their business and not do crazy stuff like that. I can see like a geopolitical orientation, strangely enough, with Iran of developing in the future, maybe even Obama's seen that. And again, also one with India as well, which is another country that has a very significant Muslim population, but tries to keep it fairly moderate, because the fact is the real expansion into Europe of Islamists, they're almost exclusively Sunnis. Hey? The Shia has a very relatively small population. They seem to be geographically wanting to stay in Iran, in Azerbaijan, in a few Gulf states. And they don't seem to be, they're certainly not in a geopolitical threat, any threat to Europe. Whereas the concern is, you know, particularly if Turkey continues to become more Islamic over time, or more, sort of closer to that Islam, the conservative Islam, or a more traditional approach to Islam, opposed to the relatively relaxed Turkish sort of secular Islam, that's another concern as well. So it's quite possible that there's, a stronger relationship over time that might build between, you know, Russia, Iran, and possibly other European countries, if the concern about Islamism becomes really significant in the future, if European Muslims become more rigorous and radical adherence to that particular form of Islam that manifests mainly from the Gulf states. So there's a lot of variables, but I'd suggest, you know, a lot of it depends how Islam develops over the next period of time, and a lot of it depends upon how European politics develop. But if I was a betting man, I'd say European politics will become increasingly nationalist in the relatively short future, and these kind of civilizational concerns that Chauprat and Huntington and other people think a lot about will probably become more manifest in your day-to-day electoral politics as well, because they're so significant. You know, a lot of people are a little bit scared and insecure in their position in the world, and they tend to sort of retreat into what they know and what they're familiar with in those scenarios.
I'd agree with you. My first podcast, I spoke to Lord Christopher Monckton of UKIP, or I guess formerly of UKIP, and we spoke about Europe and some of these issues, and he projected that for the next election, UKIP would continue to grow, so I think that's the general trend, the direction. Hayden Rippon, if I pronounced that correctly.
That's spot on, mate. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm going to post the links from your publications below so people can check them out.